Well, I was born back in Centerville, Iowa in 1938 and went to elementary school. And when I was in elementary school, the principal was also the music teacher. And of course, I didn't realize what she was doing when she asked me to sit in the front of the class. The singers, I guess, who she thought maybe were more musical or had nicer voices or whatever, to this day, I don't know. But anyhow, we got to sit in the front row. And then when I was in junior high school, the choir director named Don Gunderson of the high school choir, he heard me singing, I don't remember where or how, and he asked the principal of the junior high, it was called Howard Junior High School, 7th and 8th grade in those days, if I could come over and sing in the high school choir, because that had never been done before, and it was just kind of like across the street from the high school. So he gave permission, and I sang first soprano with the girls in the girls' section. And then I got to sing a solo, and I remember there was a lady, her name was Mrs. Poffenberger, and I was singing a song on top of Old Smokey, I think, in Sweet Little Jesus Boy, and this lady was crying. And so when I finished singing, I apologized to her. I said, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to make you cry. And she said, oh, well, they were happy tears. And then Don Gunderson realized that I had a special voice, which I still didn't realize. But that all happened in Centerville, Iowa. Then I went to the University of Iowa, and I was the first African-American to sing in the Old Gold Singers. And a teacher came to the University of Iowa in 1961. And I went to community college in Centerville before I transferred to the University of Iowa in 1957, and I was interested in pre-med and theology and psychology. Plus, I was very poor, so some semesters I couldn't go full-time, and my father passed away. And while I was in college, I was supporting my mother and a brother, so it was kind of difficult. But a teacher came to the University of Iowa named Charles Kellis, be on their voice faculty in 1961, and he heard me sing, and he said, you know, you have a voice to sing opera. And I more or less said, what's opera, having come from Centerville? And he played some recordings of me, of great opera singers, and a symphonic recording of Rimsky-Korsakov, Scheherazade, because he wanted me to hear some classical music also. So after he played his recording of great opera singers, about three or four different opera singers, and that symphony, I said, oh, I really like that stuff. I just call it stuff. So he gave me voice lessons at the University of Iowa for 2 years, and then he said, you need to go to an all-musical school. So he arranged an audition for me at the Juilliard School of Music in New York City in 1963, and they accepted me, gave me a scholarship. And in 1965, I had a chance to go to Germany and audition for a very famous manager or agent. I was still a student at Juilliard. And he asked me if I could wait, because I flew over in December, right before Christmas in 1964. He said, could you wait till after the first of the year? Because after I'd sung for him, he liked my voice. He said, I'd like you to sing for people from the Deutsche Oper in West Berlin. So he arranged that, and I went and I sang, and I was still a student, as I said, at Juilliard. When I finished singing, they offered a role of opera, King in Aida, the opera Aida by Verdi. And that started off my career in 1965, and in 66, I won the bronze medal at the famous Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow, and President Johnson was in office and invited me to the White House, and I went to the Hollywood Bowl, and then my career just took off. So that's the history up to the starting of my musical life.
From someone who had never heard of opera, and within a short amount of time, you were singing on major opera stages around the world.
Yep, today I've sung in 84 different opera houses around the world and with 115 different orchestras all around the world. And I've sung 102 different roles in opera in German, Italian, French, Spanish, Russian, Catalan, and of course English. And I just feel very, very blessed because God was the one who gave me this talent to sing, which has enabled me to achieve all of these experiences that I've had musically, humanitarily, and et cetera. So I thank God every day, or at least every week, for the gift of singing that he has given to me.
What are some of your favorite roles, or what maybe were some of your most famous or most favorite memories?
In terms of roles, as I said, I've sung 102 roles, everything that you can almost think of, by Verdi, Wagner, Puccini, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Strauss, French composers, Bizet, Gounod. I've sung all of this repertoire, but I'm known as more or less as a Wagnerian, singing Richard Wagner's music, the whole Ring cycle, the title role of The Flying Dutchman, and a Verdi singer. And I've done a number of title roles in Verdi's operas like Nabucco and Macbeth and Attila, Oberto. So some of my favorite roles would be The Flying Dutchman, Wotan in Wagner's Ring cycle, the opera Walküre, and King Philip in Verdi's opera Don Carlo. I love to sing the role of John the Baptist in the opera Salome by Strauss. And so it's kind of hard to single them out, but I do a lot of recital works by Schubert and Brahms and Mahler. Negro spiritual, of course, I sing a lot of Negro spirituals. I still sing gospel songs and hymns. So I just love different types of music.
And you have sung for some really influential people at the White House and all around the globe. Tell us about some of the people you have sung for.
I've been very honored. I've sung for, I'm not Catholic, but I've sung for two popes at the Vatican. I sang for the Billy Graham Crusade in Madison Square Garden here in the United States. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the famous archbishop from Cape Town, South Africa. Those are some of the spiritual leaders for whom I've sung around the world. I've sung for six presidents of the United States, sang many times for Nelson Mandela, sang for the Nobel Prize Committee, sang for Elie Wiesel, François Mitterrand, the president, let's say, of France, Havel, who was the president of Czechoslovakia, Rabin, before he was assassinated many years ago from Israel, Arafat. I've sung for many kings and queens, royalty, really around the world, and I feel blessed. It's like I'm on a journey, and it's been an unplanned journey because growing up in Centerville, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, I didn't know anything about opera. And I'm so grateful that I really believe that God sent Charles Kellas to the University of Iowa in 1961 to discover me. And had it not been for this man, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now or with you.
You grew up in Centerville, and you grew up in a time when Centerville probably, like everywhere else in Iowa, still had racial elements in it.
Well, not some, but a lot, really, actually. When I was growing up in Centerville, of course, in those days, I was born, say, in 1938, we were called colored people. And colored people were not allowed to eat in a number of the restaurants in Centerville. We were not allowed to swim in the swimming pool. But eventually, they would let us swim on Saturday between 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. Then we had to get out of the pool, and once we got out of the pool, they put more disinfectant into the swimming pool. We were not allowed to sit down in movie theaters downstairs with white people. We had to sit up in a little corner where the projector room was. It was very loud, and that's what they call it, the crow's nest, and that's where we had to sit. And there was discrimination in education. Little colored children were never chosen to do anything or ever chosen to be the teacher's pet, and a lot of those things. And I saw my father being discriminated against because of jobs he had to take, etc. So, and as you just said, Centerville was no different than any place else in Iowa or in the United States. Okay, it was even better up here in Iowa than it was in Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama. But there was still a tremendous amount of discrimination in Centerville. And unfortunately, we still have discrimination in this country. So we still have a ways to go. Most people don't realize, but it's 400 years ago this year, 2019, that people were brought over on slave boats from Africa. So we're not celebrating, but we're acknowledging these 400 years that we were brought to this country, not voluntarily. And of course, more than 50% of the African people died on the ships on the way over here. So I have mixed feelings about our freedom that we're supposed to have according to our Constitution and our Statue of Liberty, but we'll just keep struggling and hope the day will come when people will realize there's only one race, and it's the human race.
Please tell us, you're in the African American Museum at the Smithsonian.
Right. I was asked to be in that. A gentleman contacted me and said, we'd really like to have you in there because of your contribution to opera and classical music as a black man, because it's been very difficult for African-American women also, but especially men. And I've sung more opera than any, I don't know, there might be one other opera singer who has sung as many roles as I have, but I have sung more than any man of color, African-American man or black man in the history of opera and most other opera singers. And so I suppose that's one of the reasons why they wanted me to be in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. And there's a little short clip of my singing the title role of the opera, The Flying Dutchman by Richard Wagner. And there are only three other classical operatic people of color in that whole museum, Leontine Price, Jesse Norman, I think it's George Shirley and myself. So that was a big honor when the people contacted me before it opened. They said, we'd like to have you in the Smithsonian Museum. And so I feel very honored that I'm in there.
And because you are a fantastic singer in your own right, and you have this lineage as well as that you were a grandson of a slave.
Right. My grandfather on my father's side was a slave sold for $500. And I have pictures of him and my grandmother. And my father was born in 1891. And he couldn't read or write, but he was a great father, a great husband, and a great example for me. And my mother went through 11th grade. My mother was born in 1910 in Centerville. My father was born in either Missouri or Virginia, we're not exactly sure. But that's another reason why I just feel so blessed. I would never have dreamed growing up in Centerville that I would get farther east than maybe Chicago, and now I've been as far east as Hong Kong and Tokyo and Sydney, Australia, if you go the other way around the world, and I've sung basically on every livable continent on this planet Earth, except the Antarctic, and I haven't sung on Greenland, but I've sung all around the world, Africa, Russia, China, Berlin, Austria, Italy, Spain, Sweden, Norway, just kind of everywhere. So I've been very, very blessed.
When you were growing up in Centerville and you had all these people who were trying to put you in your place, you had some wonderful influences in your life that helped you try to keep your perspective and your own self-worth.
Well, my mother and my father were my two first great mentors. We were deeply religious. We were very, very, very poor, way below the poverty line. But we had faith in God and in church and in education. My parents always stressed faith and education. As I said, my father couldn't read or write, but he said, son, you must get an education. So I'm very grateful that that was expressed to me when I was a child growing up. E.W. Fannin was a superintendent of all of the schools in Centerville, and I was there. We had two elementary schools, junior high school, and then Centerville High School. And I remember in my junior year in high school, he invited me over to his house to have some lemonade and a piece of cake with him and his wife. I had no idea why he was inviting me over. But I went over there, and I have never forgotten what he said. He said, Simon, if you continue to keep your nose to the grindstone, you're going to be somebody someday. And I had no idea what he was talking about. My first two great mentors were my mother and my father. They stressed the importance of hard work, education, and the ability and capacity to forgive. For example, because there was tremendous discrimination in Centerville. Just as a couple of examples I would give you. For example, if I would come home and I would have told my mother that a white boy called me the N-word or hit me, my mother would say, well, then you get down on your knees and you pray for that boy. Well, that's rather difficult when you're 7 or 8 years of age. If you were to say something like that to your mother, you'd think, well, mother, you didn't understand what I said. She'd say, get down on your knees and pray. And when I started singing opera, I started in Europe. There were a lot of opera houses that wouldn't let me sing here in the United States. And I remember in the early 70s, I called my mother from New York because I was living in New York City at that time. And I was in tears. I was very sad. And I said, you know, mother, I've sung in Rome and London and Paris and Vienna, et cetera, et cetera. I said, but they still won't let me sing in some of the opera houses in my own country. Well, she said, now, son, you just get down on your knees and you pray. And now I've sung in all the major opera houses in the United States and around the world. So needless to say, prayer, the ability to forgive, My mother and father taught my sisters and me never to hate white people. We can hate what they do to us, but we must not hate them as a human being, because we're all of God's children. And my mother always taught me that to be strong, to have courage, to be humble. I remember I was speaking with a bishop one time in Ames when I was a teacher at Iowa State, where I still am, as I told you, a professor. And he was the bishop of all the Midwest Methodist churches. And I had lunch with him one time, and he said, "Why don't you have hate in your heart for white people?" And I thought for 1 second and responded, "Because I don't have any room in my heart for hate. I just have love. And love is the presence of God and Jesus Christ. And so Christ told us to forgive even our enemies. But we don't have to accept what they do to us, but we must not hate them." And so even to this day, I don't have any hate in my heart.
Thank you. That's good advice for all of us. And your parents were very, very wise. You have also sung at some very humanitarian events like the 25th and 50th anniversaries of the United Nations. And you have also sung in Oslo for a conference of the anatomy of
hate. Well, I've been, once again, I always use the word blessed. Some people say you're lucky, but I don't use the word luck, and the word luck is not in the Bible. When I was asked to come up there for the Nobel Prize Committee, they had this conference there. As you stated, it's called The Anatomy of Hate, and Elie Wiesel was there, Havel was there, Mitterrand was there, Jimmy Carter was there, Nelson Mandela was there. There were people from different areas and different professions throughout the United States were there. And the objective of that conference was, what can we do to eradicate or try to erase or reduce discrimination in the world today? And I remember when they invited me to come there and sing by the Nobel Prize Committee, they said, "You know, we can't pay you a fee. We say in Germany a Gage, but you can attend. We'll pay all of your expenses, but you can attend all the conferences," which was worth more than my fee, because I got to listen to some great people. There were professors there. There were people there from the medical profession, and poets were there, as well as spiritual leaders and presidents of many different countries. And so I went there, and I just absorbed all of this experience and knowledge that was there because of discrimination toward Jewish people and black people. And I just feel really very blessed and honored. I remember on that same program, Gregory Peck was on it, and so was Audrey Hepburn, and they were two really fine persons that I was happy to have met. But my whole life is kind of like a journey that I'm on. It's like a storybook.
You have gone on to sing benefit concerts. You sang a benefit concert with the Des Moines Symphony for the Parkersburg tornado and flooding, and you also did a benefit concert with the Wartburg College Choir for the flooding and damage that they had around Waverly.
In Waverly, yeah.
Yes.
Yes. You know, I feel those of us who are blessed, we have a responsibility to help people in need. My philosophy is that God put us on this earth for two reasons, to love Him and to love our neighbors. We love ourselves, and that's something that's in the Bible. When I was a little boy, about 11 years of age, I had three older sisters, incidentally, and my mother said, "Son, how would you like to read the Bible through with me in one whole year?" And I don't know where my mother knew about this, but she said, I remember she said, "If we read three chapters a day and five on Sunday, we will complete the Bible in a year." So I did that with my mother. Until this day, 99% of the days out of 365, I read and study my Bible every day. I've read it through and studied it through three times in my lifetime, and I still read it basically every day of my life, because it's a book that gives us guidelines in how to live as a human being and as a spiritual person. And people often say, "Who is God? What is God?" Well, God is love, and love is God. It's interchangeable. And so that's why I have the philosophy that I have, is trying to follow after the life of Jesus Christ, who told us to love our enemies and to love those who persecute us. And Jesus said He came on this earth to feed the poor, the widow, the orphan, and people who are falsely imprisoned. He said, this is why he came on this earth. And so my parents taught me this, and I learned this at a very young age from the Bible. And I feel very blessed that I had the two type of parents that I had, my mother and my father, and some teachers who motivated me, including E.W. Fannin, that superintendent that I mentioned to you earlier in Centerville, who encouraged me. And I feel so blessed because I had positive input into my life as I was developing as a child. And I've learned over the years that you catch more flies with honey than you do vinegar.
You performed with the Simon Estes Music High School Choir at the World Cup in Johannesburg in 2010, and this was a very influential concert for you. Tell us about that performance and how it really impacted you.
I was invited to go sing at the grand finale concert of the World Cup in Johannesburg, South Africa in 2010. And I founded a choir, a high school choir, and a high school in South Africa a number of years before that. And it's called the Simon Estes Music High School. And my choir sang for Bill Clinton, and they sang for royalty, kings and queens, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, in 2010, I was invited to sing in the final concert, the grand finale concert of the World Cup, you know, the soccer. And before I went out to sing, the moderator mentioned that 90% of all the malaria deaths in the world were in sub-Saharan Africa, and every 30 seconds a child was dying, and 1 million children were dying every year from a mosquito bite, and they got malaria. And that really touched my heart. It's a long story, but I'll skip ahead. And so it was heavy on my heart. And so around 2013, I decided I wanted to start raising money, because all they needed to save those children's lives was a $5 chemically treated net. So when the mosquito touches the net, it dies immediately and cannot fly and transmit malaria to someone else. And so my wife and I flew out to Washington, D.C., because I heard that the United Nations Foundation had a department called Nothing But Nets, and met with the necessary people and got more information. And they said, well, it's true. 1 million children, little African children, are needlessly dying from a mosquito bite, and all they need is a $5 treated net in which to sleep. So I really feel that God laid that or put that on my heart or in my heart to do something about it. And I asked them while we were there, now this was 2013, said, well, how many children have died in the last 20 years, for example? They said 20 million children had died, and all they need is a $5 treated net under which to sleep. In fact, you can get two children under those nets. And so I went on a campaign of singing, and I sang, and I got over 1,000 high school students in December of 2013 to do a concert with me at the Hilton Coliseums at Iowa State University campus, and we raised $100,000 through that concert. And I was so touched with these high school students from 52 different high schools. They came and performed with me there. It was one of the greatest experiences that I have had. And I gave every penny of that money to the United Nations Foundation, Nothing But Nets. And an anonymous donor heard what I had done with these children here in Iowa. They sent another $265,000. So between 2013 and through 2017-18, I raised a total of $532,000, and I gave every penny of that money to the United Nations Foundation to buy nets to help save these children's lives in Africa. And there are still about 400,000 or more dying every year still in Africa. And the reason the children die who are 5 years of age and under is their immune systems haven't developed enough. So when they get bitten by a mosquito within, you know, 7 to 9 days, they die. But people who are older get bitten and they don't die. And when I heard about that terrible tornado in Parkersburg, of course, I was a professor at Waverly at Wartburg, and it was only about 15, 20 miles from Waverly. So I drove up right after that horrible tornado devastated this little town. And I was just so shocked. Anyhow, a lady asked me, could I help them? So anyhow, I sang a couple of songs on a Yankee Doodle Pops concert with Joseph Junta, the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra. And they just passed the bucket around at the end of that concert after I sang a couple of songs. And we collected $38,000, and I gave it all to Parkersburg to help them because of the tragedy that hit them with that horrible tornado. So I look at myself as a servant of God's who is just trying to help people. As I say, I think we're put on this earth for two basic reasons, to serve the Lord and to serve one another. So that's why I help those children. I often say many times, no child ever asked to be born. And we as adults and those of us who are blessed, we have a responsibility to make sure that children get three different forms of nourishment in their lives. They need food, nutrition for their bodies to develop. They need education for their brains to develop. I'm a Christian, so I get my Christian nourishment by reading my Bible every day and going to church. So our spirits need nourishment. So those of us who are adults, I really do believe we have this responsibility to make sure that no child is hungry or denied the opportunity to get an education or to know about God, who is love. I think we have a responsibility to lead them and to help them.
Thank you for all of your humanitarian efforts here in Iowa and around the globe. You are very inspiring, Professor Estes. Thank you so much. You are going to be singing with the Des Moines Symphony, and you're going to be singing excerpts from Porgy and Bess. And in 1985, you were the Metropolitan Opera's first Porgy. So tell us about this role and being on the Metropolitan Opera stage.
Well, I've sung in a number of the other operas, of course, on the Metropolitan Opera stage eventually. But the idea came back, Joseph Junta and I were talking. He said, let's do a concert together, Simon, because I've sung with him for over 30 years since he's been here. He's a great conductor, incidentally. Well, I'm also going to sing an aria called Il Lacerato Spirito from Verdi's opera Simone Boccanegra. And the character that I sing, his name is Fiesco. And we decided to do that aria because everyone has been saying for years, Simon, there needs to be a documentary or a movie on your life, because going clear back to the slavery of your grandfather up to what you have been blessed with and achieved, there needs to be a movie. So something has been done to raise some money for me to start this documentary. And I'm going to, I think, really do this at the right time and in the right conditions, just to hope that it'll help bring us human beings closer together.
I do want to hear about this documentary and when we can all enjoy seeing it.
Well, there have been some people from the East Coast to Iowa who really want to help direct this. And so we're raising money. I already have a pledge of a substantial amount. And we're going to start it, believe it or not, when I sing on the 27th and 28th with the Des Moines Symphony. That's going to be kind of my first, let's say, acknowledgement that we're really serious about doing this documentary. And that's why I'm going to sing, in addition to excerpts from Porgy and Bess, I'm going to sing Il Lacerato Spirito. That is the first operatic aria that Mr. Charles Kellis taught me in 1961 when he came to the University of Iowa and introduced me to opera. And I've actually sung that role of opera before, of Fiesco, in the opera Simone Boccanegra. And I've also sung the title role, Simone Boccanegra, in that opera. So Joseph Junta and I thought, hey, why not do this first aria, Simon, in which you were introduced to opera with the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra. And I'm so happy the orchestra's going to play this, because I've sung, as I told you, with 114 other symphony orchestras around the world, like the Des Moines Symphony. And I really wanted to do this aria at the beginning of the program, so I'm going to do that, and then we will do Porgy and Bess.
It's really neat because it is such a special aria for you and it has so much meaning to you. And I think Charles Kellis is probably looking down from heaven and he'll be smiling as well.
Well, you know something? He doesn't have to look down from heaven because he's still alive.
Oh, he is.
On the 12th of this month, he will be 92, and he's still alive in New York. I just spoke with him yesterday, and he's still teaching. He is still teaching. And without that man, I would not be here today, because when I was at the University of Iowa, I wanted to sing in the University of Iowa chorus. I won't mention the gentleman's name who was the head of the voice department and was the main choral director, but I said, may I sing in the University of Iowa chorus? He said, no, 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 your voice isn't good enough. And so he was the head of the voice department. I said, well, could I take voice lessons with you? He said, no, 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 I wouldn't waste my time with you. You have no talent. He said, however, there's a young teacher coming here this fall. Maybe he will take you. And I didn't realize it then, because I was rather naive, even though I'd grown up with racial discrimination, but I think he had a sociological problem that he didn't want a person of color, at least not my color or by me, to sing in the University of Iowa chorus. But Mr. Kellis came, and he took me, he heard me, and you know the rest of the story.
You sang the first Porgy at the Metropolitan Opera, and you said later you had sung many, many roles at the Metropolitan Opera.
Right. Gershwin wrote it as an opera, but it wasn't performed as it should have been, in my opinion, and given the dignity that it deserved, because the main characters in that whole opera were colored people, as they were called back in those days. And so most of the time it was done as a Broadway musical. And that's a long story that I won't take too much of our time explaining it, but it had some pluses and some minuses. But I will say this, the music itself is some of the greatest music ever composed, and it's one of the greatest operas, in my opinion, even though it hasn't been performed in enough opera houses around the world. And if you think about it, the Metropolitan Opera had never done Porgy and Bess until 1985, when I sang Porgy there in that particular year. And it's a tragedy because it's got some of the greatest melodies and songs that you'd ever hear. But because the subject was that of African Americans, or of colored people as we were calling those days, and the majority of the cast and the nice people were colored, opera houses wouldn't perform it. And so eventually they did. As I say, I have sung other operas at Metropolitan Opera, but they asked me would I sing, because I was the most promised and famous, I say that with humility, black or African-American opera singer. So they asked me to do Porgy, and I said yes. And it was a huge success. Every single performance was sold out. It's a great work. It's one of the greatest operas. I told you I've sung 102 different roles in opera. And Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is one of the greatest operas ever written. The audiences, they always absolutely love it. I've sung it in Zurich, Switzerland. I've sung it in the United States. And it's just a great, great opera. And we're going to do some excerpts from that particular American-composed opera by George Gershwin, Porgy and Bess.
Tell us about the character Porgy and why you love his character so much.
Well, he's a crippled man, and he's actually a very good man. And because he's crippled, he wasn't really mobile in that particular area of Caroline in those days. It was written from a city like that. And he wanted to have, obviously, a girlfriend, even though he was a cripple. He was on crutches and bent knees and that sort of thing. And so he finally meets this young lady named Bess, and he falls in love with Bess. Most operas are kind of like that. Somebody's falling in love with someone, or they're about a king and a queen, or children of somebody. And so Porgy finally falls in love with Bess, and Bess had problems with drugs and that sort of thing, and she fell in love, or maybe not really love, but got involved with another character named Crown in the opera, and Crown is not a nice person in the black community, and also it's an opera that shows how important prayer and spirituals were to the people of color, because Serena, one of the characters, Bess got very, very sick. And so Serena says, let me pray over her. And she sings this beautiful song. Now, also because her husband got killed, my man's gone now. But anyhow, when Bess is real, real sick, Serena tells all the people, and Porgy especially, that I'm going to pray over this woman, she says. And so after she finishes praying, she looks at Porgy and she says, Porgy, by 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, that woman's going to be okay. Well, the next day, Bess was well again. So she and Porgy fell in love. But the opera ends kind of tragic, because there's a guy called Sporting Life who's a drug dealer. gets Bess back on drugs, and so she goes off with him to New York, and the opera ends with Porgy. He had a cart that he rode on and had a donkey pulling the cart or a horse, and so he says, I'm on my way. He's going to try to go to New York and see if he can get Bess back. So it's an interesting story, and it's got great, great music and great lyrics and words in it.
Tell us about some of the pieces that you will be singing in the concert.
Well, I'm going to sing the role of Porgy. And then I'm going to sing another aria that another character called Jake. He sings A Woman is a Sometime Thing. Then I'll sing the duet, Bess, You Is My Woman Now, with a young lady who will be singing Bess. I will sing the famous song that Porgy sings, Oh, I Got Plenty of Nothing. And I'm going to sing a role that a tenor sings, Sporting Life, It Ain't Necessarily So. And then we will end the concert with I'm On My Way. That ends a whole opera with the choir and Porgy singing it with the orchestra. So that's some of the music that we'll be singing. The young lady I know will be singing the aria Summertime and some other repertoire.
So you get to sing all the hits. That'll be fun.
Well, I shall try.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I never dreamed I would be back in Iowa because my roots are here, of course, but I'm delighted to be back here. I'm really happy to be teaching at Iowa State University and DMAC College. I'm very happy that when I came back here from Boston University, I raised a lot of money. I went out and did some singing engagements, and I'm still doing it. I want to sing in all 99 counties, and I've now sung in 55. And I give scholarships to high school graduating students, and I started that a few years ago. And I've given over 200 scholarships and over $200,000 to high school students who are in Iowa who have financial need, who want to go to college or university and pursue their dream of getting an education. So I'm just happy to be back in Iowa. I was very honored by having received the Iowa Award some time ago, and I feel very blessed in that. And I'm doing whatever I can to help Iowa, and I have some wonderful people and wonderful friends here in Iowa. And so I'm happy to have had the chance to speak with you in Iowa Public